From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Larry Nassar, sex abuse survivors, legislators, and trustees are calling for former Governor John Engler to resign as Michigan State University's interim president because of emails.
They were despicable, and they angered not only me, they angered the entire MSU community.
Michigan passed a law that bars the state from helping the U.S. government with warrantless surveillance.
If the feds want to do that, if they want to spy on U.S. citizens, they're not going to do it from Michigan soil.
The opioid crisis is causing death, havoc among families, and costing the state and cities a lot of money, but a Michigan law protects the opioid manufacturers from lawsuits.
Michigan residents cannot bring product liability lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies.
Plus, we'll tell you about microplastics in your beer and then hear about a cocktail from an award-winning Michigan bartender.
I like my cocktails to tell a story if at all possible.
All of that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Lawmakers, sexual abuse survivors, the former sports doctor Larry Nassar, and two Michigan State University trustees are calling for interim president John Engler's resignation. We'll hear from one of those trustees later this hour. But first, the opioid epidemic is causing death and havoc for families all across the U.S. Hundreds of state and local governments have filed lawsuits against the manufacturers of drugs, alleging they made false claims in marketing, saying that the drugs are not addictive. 50 cities in this state are suing. But in Michigan, there's a huge hurdle because of a law Bill Schuette co-sponsored while a legislator. That story came out today in the Detroit News. Karen Buffard is the reporter, and she joins us now. So what is this law?
Well, it's the 1995 Michigan Product Liability Act, and it was passed again in 1995, passed shortly after Republicans took possession of the House of Representatives after, I believe it was about 26 years, that they had not had a majority in the House. And so it was during a time when there was a lot of fervor to quickly get conservative, business-friendly legislation passed in the legislature, and they got it passed.
So this was a Michigan Chamber of Commerce-backed legislation. Bill Schuette carried the water for the chamber. What exactly does it do?
First of all, there were quite a few sponsors. Bill Schuette was not the only sponsor, but he was definitely a sponsor of the bill. What this bill does is it says that Michigan residents, and not just residents, but that has also included the state of Michigan, cannot bring product liability lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies for drugs that were approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration and labeled according to FDA standards.
How common is this? Do most other states have laws making pharmaceutical companies immune from lawsuits?
No. This is widely recognized as the most severe for consumers law of its type in the nation. It's basically the only one that has consistently barred these kinds of lawsuits. And speaking with attorneys that have tried to bring suits and been blocked by this law, it also has to do with the way the law has been interpreted by Michigan judges. Judges in Michigan at both the district and appellate level, and then affirmed by the Michigan Supreme Court, they've actually read this law in the most conservative way possible and determined that it was the intent of the legislature to bar all of these lawsuits, even in cases where the drug was approved but then used for an off-label use. In other words, the drugs were approved, say, for use in adults, but then they were used in children, or they were approved for one condition, but then they were used for another condition and marketed for use in that off-label way.
What does then co-sponsor, now Attorney General Bill Schuette, think of the law he supported in 1995?
Well, I initially emailed and got kind of a vague response, but then after asking for more detailed information about Michigan's history of collecting on lawsuits and so forth, the Attorney General's office came back with a statement saying that Bill Schuette would consider changing any law that keeps Michigan consumers from having their rights protected, including this 1995 product liability law.
Those 50 communities that are suing now in Michigan, how are these towns and cities actually hurt by the opioid crisis, first of all?
Oh, my gosh. The opioid crisis has just been disastrous economically for governments, from the state government to local governments, townships, municipalities, counties. They've all had to increase law enforcement efforts. Most police officers now carry naloxone in their cars, which is a very expensive drug that can be used to reverse the effects of an opioid overdose. That's very expensive. They've had to increase treatment opportunities. They've had to come up with jail space for people. They've also increased enforcement efforts to try to deal with people who are selling the drugs to these addicted people. So, and county coroners have to do more autopsies. It's just an endless list of ways that the opioid crisis has, you know, been an economic burden for governments all over the state.
So beyond this toll in human life, this has had real cost for municipalities across the state. So how does this law affect those communities' lawsuits?
Well, I've talked to a number of attorneys who say that they believe that this law could be an obstacle to those lawsuits, because if the judges decide that these lawsuits come under the Michigan Product Liability Act, they could toss these cases out of court. Now, I have spoken with other attorneys, including one of the attorneys from the city of Detroit, who says that they're going to try to do an end run around the law by trying to frame it around some other federal act, like say that it's a False Claims Act, because the drug companies marketed the drug based on false information that opioids weren't addictive. They could try to find other kinds of federal laws that this might come under. But I spoke to a law professor from Wayne State University who said, yes, you can try to frame the law differently, but in the end, the judge could come back and say, no, this is a product liability lawsuit, and still throw it out. So I think everybody's kind of watching and waiting to see how the judge in Cleveland, who will be listening to all these cases from around the nation, will regard Michigan's law. Another thing to keep in mind is that these lawsuits are not only suing the drug manufacturers, but they're going after the drugstores, big drugstore chains that sold the drugs, and they're going after wholesalers. So they're trying to spread the blame out among different kinds of parties so that they're not just focusing on the drug companies.
Right,
so,
up and down the chain,
Yes.
You also reported a state senator has been trying to get this immunity for pharmaceutical companies law repealed. He's not had much success. Why?
Right. That's Senator Steve Bita, and he has tried to introduce legislation to repeal the law 7 times. He's been in the legislature for a long time. And, you know, Democrats were opposed to this law when it passed. They didn't have a majority in the House at that time, and they're still opposed to it. But with a, you know, Republican majority, it just hasn't been able to get much traction. One thing that I did see in my reading up on this law is that there was really very little press coverage of this when it passed. It really was not something that the public was aware of. And I think that some of these people are hoping that by making the public more aware of the way that this law actually impacts consumers and could potentially impact these governments, these local governments, that maybe the legislature will take another look at this law and see whether it's something that we really want and need.
Karen Buffard is a reporter with the Detroit News. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Lester.
That's the sound of an imam leading prayer at Burton Manor in Livonia. The banquet hall is where more than 1,000 Detroit area Muslims celebrated Eid, the end of Ramadan, earlier this morning. The end of the holy month also marks the end of fasting during daylight hours. And to celebrate the occasion, some of the worshipers head up the street to IHOP, the International Pancakes. Or I guess I should say IHOB, because the company just announced it was replacing the P with a B. So now it's International House of Burgers. I digress. Stateside's Joey Horan talked with some of the IHOB patrons to find out how the chain became an unofficial tradition for so many Muslim families.
I'll be honest with you, I'm not really sure. Basically, for us, it's just a habit. We've been here, it's close by. Food is pretty decent. So we just kind of just make it a tradition for us. So go for the prayer, which is the most important from the prayer. It's a hop and a skip right to this place, so it's pretty cool.
I don't know, is this where we go? The one in Dearborn is always too packed, but apparently it's the word's getting out to the Livonia one as well. Really, it just means an inexpensive, nice place to go get something to eat that we haven't been able to have breakfast for a month.
Why we come here? It's because it's right across the street. It's a proximity rule where our prayer hall is right across the street. We rent out Burton Manor, and so it's been a tradition for years because it's right down the street and we all want pancakes. And it's the end of Ramadan, so we actually get to eat during the day today. And people like IHOP. We like pancakes. We like to eat some good breakfast food.
IHOP.
I'm not sure about IHOP. Yeah, I'm cool with IHOP.
I'm not sure about that either.
Yeah, we like the P.
Why'd they do that?
Is it burgers or breakfast?
Burgers.
Because if it's breakfast, burgers. I'm okay with it. But if it's burgers, then...
I think they're rebranded.
I think IHOP was original because it was pancakes. Nobody else has that. Burgers are everywhere.
It's just nice to try something different, you know, get out of the community, go someplace else and get something else, you know, instead of the usual stuff that we usually have. It's great to be, you know, to celebrate with different cultures. You don't just have Lebanese, you have Palestinians, you have Jordanians, you have Egyptians, you have Pakistanis, you have all different cultures inside. And that's the good thing about it. Islam, you know, doesn't discriminate against that. We're all united as one.
The location is very convenient. It's right next to the prayer hall that we pray at. And so when, you know, after prayer, we always get together at IHOP and, you know, just break bread together, basically. I like the cinnamon stack pancakes. My favorite.
Coming up, something you don't really want to hear, there's plastic in your beer. But a new study found that just might be the case. We'll hear about that in about 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we are at our favorite bar, The Last Word, to talk to a special bartender.
We're here with Casey Miller, who's just back from winning the right to represent the entire Midwest region in a big cocktail competition. Casey, can you tell us about that?
So it's the USBG World Class Bartending Championship by Diageo's. And so I just got back from Las Vegas a little while ago, where I was chosen as one of three national representatives from the Midwest region.
Well, congratulations. That's great. Even better, you've got a cocktail for us. We ask you to come up with a concoction that involves Michigan ingredients. What do you have here?
This cocktail I call the Kibbe Cup. It's named after a little region of Jackson, Michigan, where we would always go back in the summer. It's a cocktail that I wanted to incorporate a lot of these ingredients that I kind of think embody summers and springs in Michigan.
Yeah, I think, Casey, you have won an award for the most ingredients used in any Cheers cocktail so far. I was amazed as you just kept pulling out something more as you were mixing this up. So I see a lovely Michigan spirit on the counter here. What did you use today?
Today, I decided to use the Arbor Spring Gin from Arbor Distilling Company. They produce this gin just down the street. This gin I wanted to use because it has a lot of interesting botanicals, some of which were actually foraged right here in Michigan. So some of the accents I wanted to highlight, obviously it's a gin, so it's juniper forward. We all know that. But other ingredients include like bee pollen, chocolate mint, a little chaga mushroom, which they grab off of birch trees that grow right here in Michigan, northern Michigan. And then in addition to that, kind of highlighting those botanicals with some of the other produce items.
I see you also used Werner's, which is very Michigan-like of you.
It is the quintessential Michigan soda in my mind, you know?
Okay, so why don't you walk us through how you made this cocktail?
When I was kind of envisioning what I wanted to do, I wanted to really bring something from my past. I like my cocktails to tell a story, if at all possible. And so I grew up overseas in Tokyo, Japan, and every summer we would come back and visit Michigan, and we'd stay with friends and family. And so a couple of family friends, the Sawickis, lived over in Jackson, right near Kibbe Cobb Market, just off the golf course. And something that always blew my mind was that we'd be getting ready for dinner, and Bernie would come in from his garden with just a basket of fresh strawberries or raspberries that he picked, or rhubarb that he picked. And it just, where did you get all this stuff? Oh, just right there, edge of the yard. Go pick some strawberries if you want. Here, grab this rhubarb stalk and dip it in a cup of sugar. You know, it's just this, it was so heartwarming, and in my mind just kind of, I had a very romanticized idea of Midwestern American living, and it just kind of embodied it for me. So I wanted to really incorporate all those elements of produce to it. So we have some fresh mint, we have some raspberries and strawberries. This morning I made a little rhubarb syrup with Michigan honey and Michigan rhubarb, some salted plum, some pickled plum, and a little bit of celery shrub.
Well, how do you make the drink?
You start by adding one strawberry, three raspberries, about a bar spoon of pickled plum. You muddle all that up, and then you add your liquid ingredients. So an ounce and a quarter of this spring gin, quarter ounce of Dolin Blanc vermouth, a couple dashes of celery shrub bitters, a quarter ounce each of lemon and lime juice, and then half ounce of this, the rhubarb syrup. So after adding all those liquid ingredients, toss in your mint, add some ice, give it a shake, and then double strain out the, you know, you don't want that pulp in the drink. Over ice in a highball glass, and then top it off with the 1 to 2 ounces of Werner's to taste. Give it a stir and drink spring and summer in a glass.
So when I tasted this, I was like, there must be some kind of shrub in here, because I got that little hint of vinegar or pickle or something that I wasn't familiar with. So I was great when you said that that was pickled plum. I was like, oh, that's what's going on. It's kind of got that sour, salty. Is that an ingredient you made or something that you buy?
This is an ingredient I made because I just started my hand at pickling, and I am terrible at it. Compared to the Sawickis that, you know, this what this cocktail is really, you know, kind of an homage to, they always had jars of pickles. And so I wanted to incorporate that kind of, you know, little slight brininess into the cocktail.
Is there a substitute we could use if we don't pickle plums?
You know, there are Asian markets around here that sell, they might be marketed as salted plums or pickled plums, or umeboshi is the Japanese name. Yeah, just make sure you don't grab one with a pit.
And how about that rhubarb syrup? How would someone make that?
Well, the rhubarb syrup is very easy. You roughly chop some rhubarb, throw in about 4 cups of rhubarb, 1 cup of sugar, 1 cup of water, and just let it simmer on the saucepan for about 20 minutes until the rhubarb starts to break up, and then just strain it out.
And once you have that ingredient, I bet that can get used in a lot of different ways. I would put that with some club soda and gin, and that would be a really refreshing drink that doesn't have quite as many ingredients in it.
Certainly, yeah. It's a very versatile ingredient. You can pour it over ice cream if you want to have a, you know, a nice treat for the kids. Make a non-alcoholic cocktail, which is soda or some Werner's. Or use it, yeah, as a cocktail ingredient, because it'll keep for a month in your fridge.
You had a taste of it. I'm going to give it a little try now and see if I like it as much as you seem to. Wow, there's a lot going on in that. I really like that.
That's sort of the hallmark of Casey's cocktail style. I've been privileged to have Casey make many cocktails for me over the years, and every single one of them has something in it that surprises me, because he really is always thinking about layering those flavors.
Yeah, there's nothing simple about that, and there's nothing bad about that. It is truly a nice cocktail, and as Tammy will tell you, if I don't like it, you don't get praise like that.
Thanks, Lester. That means a lot.
That's the Kibbe Cobb, and you'll have the recipe online.
Cheers.
Well, besides cocktails, I'm also a fan of Michigan craft beer. When I learned of a study which found microplastic fibers in Great Lakes beers, it got my attention. Mary Kasuth conducted the study, and she joins me there now. Hi there.
Hi.
So how do microplastics get into the environment? What's the source?
all kinds of ways they can get into the environment. A lot of it just comes from our overall production, which has grown at a staggering rate. In the 1970s, global production was around 30 million tons, and by 2016, according to Plastic Europe, we were generating about 335 million tons globally.
Of plastic.
Yep. So a lot of the stuff is just, I mean, we might throw it away. A small portion of it might be incinerated. An even smaller portion might be recycled. But the vast majority of it, almost 80%, is landfilled. And so this just continues to break down. So it's not really terribly shocking when we find it in consumer products or water.
Do these plastics affect human health?
That's a great question. Some of the major concerns are some of the plasticizers that might be added to plastics. Plastics themselves may be inert, but they have things like phthalates and bisphenol A, colorants, UV stabilizers in them.
And some of those are endocrine disruptors, right?
That's right, and that could be an issue. Another problem is that we found in marine environments, at least, these plastic particles are very good at adsorbing chemicals from the water. So things like PCBs, DDT, brominated flame retardants, things like these can actually form a coating on the outside of the plastic particles, which means that we would be ingesting higher amounts of that.
Okay, your study was limited to Great Lakes beers. What kind of limitations on the water? I mean, was this Great Lakes region, or was this definitely from the Great Lakes through a municipal system?
The actual beers that we selected drew water from the Great Lakes, and the reason we decided to do that is a study that came out in 2014 looked at 24 brands of German beer. We wanted to see if that was just a regional problem or if it's in something that we might be suffering from in our neck of the woods as well. So we looked at beers that drew their waters from the Great Lakes, and then we tested the tap water from those regions as well to see if there was any correlation between the amount of plastics we found in the beer and the amount of plastics we found in the tap water.
How did that compare?
Surprisingly, there was no correlation. So that leads us to believe that perhaps the particles are actually getting in through the beer-making process and not from the source water. But we need more research.
Were there any plastics in the source water?
Yes, there were small amounts. Mm-hmm. But they didn't correspond with the amounts that were in the beer.
That's interesting. So you mentioned that study about German beers. Are Great Lakes beers any worse or better than other beers?
Well, according to our averages, we actually had fewer plastic particles in our study for beer than they did.
Are the brewers of the Great Lakes region aware of microplastics in their beers?
I suppose they are now. because to my knowledge, we have never tested American beers before. So this is kind of a new thing. We didn't publish any of the actual names of the breweries because we don't intend to shame anybody. But we just want evidence that it's there. As long as we know that there's a problem, then we can kind of take some action to protect ourselves from it. But the first step, of course, is trying to figure out if there's a problem at all.
Where did these breweries actually get their water? Which lakes are we talking about?
Oh, all five of the Great Lakes. There were three from Superior, four from Michigan. There was, I believe, only one from Lake Huron, two from Erie, and two from Ontario.
So if we're getting more plastics in the brewing process, any idea where that plastic might be coming from?
We don't really know yet because the beer-making process or the salt-making process or any of the other beverages that we consume, if we find plastic in them, it hasn't really been studied yet. But that is something that I'm hoping to work on in the very near future.
So why did you choose beer over something like bottled water from a municipal system that uses Great Lakes?
So our study had three components, beer, salt, and tap water. And we decided to study beer and salt because each of those had already been tested in other research facilities. And so those were sort of me too studies to see if we would end up with the same results that they came up with. And then we also started working with this organization called Orb Media. They had all of the resources to gather tap water samples. And so that's kind of how our tap water study came into being. Very soon after my paper was published, my research advisor, Dr. Sam Mason in Fredonia, New York, she actually published a paper that looked at bottled water. So this is kind of a new area of research. There's so many things that one could look at. We just decided to choose those three things.
I'm curious what that bottled water study says, because the impulse is to say, okay, if the tap water has plastic in it, I'll drink bottled water. What did it show?
It's not any better. She looked at 11 brands of bottled water. There were more than 250 samples that she tested. And she used a different method than my method for tap water. But if you compare the same size that I was looking at, there were actually twice as many plastic particles in bottled water than there was in tap water.
There's something really ironic about getting plastic bottled water that has plastic in it because you want to get away from the tap water that has plastic in it.
Right, right. So this is obviously a problem that we can't really filter our way out of. Buying bottled water is only going to contribute to the problem further. So we just need to really have a conversation, a national and maybe international conversation, about the single-use disposable plastic that has just become so convenient and so common that we don't even think about it anymore.
If there are microplastics in tap water or in our beer from Great Lakes, and there is clearly, what can we do about that at home? Is there a way to filter the water or filter the beer? Although I don't know I want to bother filtering my beer, but can they do it at the brewery? Is there some way we can strain this stuff out?
Again, our municipal, at least in Minneapolis, our municipal water system, they do an excellent job of filtering these things out. And so, you know, the water that you get out of your tap might be pretty clean of all of these things, but even this material is so ubiquitous. I mean, I'm wearing a synthetic jacket right now, and it's made out of polymers, you know, and just by, like, standing next to my water cup here and abrading the sleeve, I could be releasing plastic particles that end up getting into my cup. So I think there really isn't a great way to deal with this unless we talk about the sources.
Marika Suth is an assistant professor of environmental science at Dunwoody College of Technology. She conducted the study as a student at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Hey, thanks for telling us. Not great news, but thanks anyway.
Yeah, thanks for helping us tell our story.
This week, the U.S. Supreme Court released a decision that could strengthen the fishing rights of Native American tribes across the nation. And it might even give tribes the legal framework to fight Enbridge Live 5. The case was based out of the state of Washington. That state will now have to remove or alter up to 900 culverts that environmentally damage streams or impede salmon from migrating. Those salmon runs are protected by treaties between the tribes and the U.S. government. Here to talk about the broader implications of this Supreme Court decision is Matthew Fletcher. He's a professor of law and director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So this case, as I mentioned, was about tribes in Washington. How do you see it affecting treaties and tribes in Michigan or the Great Lakes area?
Well, it affects Michigan tribes and basically any tribe in the United States with a treaty that involves off-reservation hunting, fishing, gathering, agriculture, travel, what have you. The legal theory in Washington State basically was the tribes reserved in the treaty the right to fish on anadromous fish off-reservation and fish that go upstream in order to spawn, like salmon. And the idea, the theory behind it was that the treaties preserve a right to a habitat to allow for those fish to actually exist, for tribes to fish in them. The greater theory of every Indian treaty between the United States and Indian tribes, anywhere near there's a water source that involves hunting and fishing, is that the reservation, which is a smaller part of the treaty, where the tribe agrees to go live, the agreement to go live on the reservation is dependent on the ability to leave the reservation to go hunt and fish off reservation for subsistence, for food and shelter, for commercial purposes as well. And really, the reservation is designed to be a homeland for Indian tribes. Supreme Court said that actually way back in 1908 when in a water rights case also in Washington State called Winters versus United States, basically saying, if the tribe, in that case, didn't have access to water, then there would be no point to having a reservation. It would be completely dry. Nobody could live there.
So this basically gives tribes the right to their traditional hunting and fishing grounds under these treaties, most of these treaties. Is that correct?
Right. The ones that are relevant here in the Culverts case and also the very similar language in the Great Lakes.
How does this decision change what defines a violation of a treaty?
And it doesn't really change anything. So we don't have a decision, an actual written opinion from the United States Supreme Court in this case because there was a 4-4 tie and their practice is not to issue an opinion. So that was definitely the issue when they argued the case, and the way it was briefed was to try to figure out a standard by which to apply to determine whether or not there was a breach of a treaty. So since that was never defined by the Supreme Court, that's still an open question. So we still have to address that in the Great Lakes. But in the Ninth Circuit, if you can show that there's a substantial impact on the habitat itself, the broader habitat of the fish or the game or whatever it is that the tribes are harvesting, then you have a treaty breach. You have a violation of the treaty.
So how could Great Lakes tribes use this U.S. Supreme Court decision to possibly contest Enbridge Line 5?
As with any legal strategy, you try to find a legal pressure point. And what's going on with Line 5 right now is that Enbridge is, at least according to the tribes, clandestinely trying to replace the pipeline. And they're calling it replacing maintenance and replacing certain kind of anchor supports. But effectively, it's replacing a large portion of the pipeline as it exists there. And if it's a big enough replacement, a big enough change, then that implicates the National Environmental Policy Act. It implicates Environmental Protection Agency review, the Army Corps of Engineers obligations under various federal statutes. And that's where the tribes can jump in and say, hey, you're making a change to this pipeline. You have to consult with tribes. But more importantly, for purposes of this argument that was just had in the Supreme Court, if it can be shown that it's a possibility, and we don't know what that possibility is, but if it can be shown as a possibility that the pipeline would rupture sort of a catastrophic release of oil, then that directly affects the tribe's treaty rights. The strongest arguments the tribe could end up making is that you got to get rid of the pipeline altogether, because no matter how safe you make the pipeline, Enbridge, it's still going to be a potential rupture someday. There's no perfect situation where you can have a perfect pipeline. It's just not going to happen. So you got to get rid of it. That would guarantee tribal treaty rights, the access to the off-reservation Great Lakes fishing rights that are preserved by treaty in the United States versus Michigan case going all the way back to the 1970s.
Matthew Fletcher is a professor of law and the director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
No problem.
Still to come, we'll discuss what's in the budget the state legislature approved just before heading out for the summer. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, the Detroit Free Press and the Chronicle of Higher Education released emails between Michigan State University administrators. They dealt with their concerns about lawsuits from survivors of former MSU sports doctor Larry Nassar's sexual abuse. In the emails, interim president of Michigan State University, John Engler, suggested a survivor, Rachel Denhollander, was likely to get a kickback from her lawyer for the, quote, manipulation of other survivors. Survivors are calling for John Engler's resignation now. Some lawmakers are calling for Engler's resignation. This morning, one of the Michigan State University Board of Trustees, Brian Masalam, called for Engler to step aside. Today, Engler said he would not resign and, in a statement, indicated he was still looking ahead. Joining me now is another MSU trustee, Diane Byram. Welcome to the program.
Hello there.
What did you think of those statements and those emails that Engler wrote, which seemed to show little empathy for the victims of the sexual abuse by an MSU employee for nearly two decades?
Well, they made me very angry. I thought they were, frankly, despicable. They were hurtful to the survivors. It was a misstep. It was unnecessary. And it, frankly, it sets the university back in terms of its ability to move forward and to heal. Not only the university to heal, but the survivors to heal. That's why earlier this week I called for interim president Engler to publicly apologize for his comments. They were despicable, and they angered not only me, they angered the entire MSU community, and you've already discussed the reactions by the survivors. He failed to do that. And in my mind, the failure to be able to apologize for your mistakes indicated to me that he was not the leader for Michigan State University.
Are you calling on him to resign?
I am calling on him to resign. I thought the lack of a public apology for those hurtful remarks indicated to me that he was not the person to lead the university forward, even in an interim basis.
You've got a trustees meeting next week. What do you think the board will do regarding these emails to and from John Engler?
Well, I don't want to speak for the board. I can speak for myself, and that's why I am publicly talking about this. Again, I called for an apology. I thought that was what you should do when you make a mistake. You should own that mistake, and you should apologize. When that didn't happen, I took the next step, and that's my comments today, my statement I released today, saying that we're not going to be able to move forward on the healing process as long as we have a leader who will not acknowledge and apologize for their mistakes. And so John Engler is not the leader for Michigan State University.
What can you do if he says he's not going anywhere?
I can control what I can do, and I'm publicly speaking out, making my feelings known. And I'm going to continue focusing on what we need to do for the future of Michigan State University, and that's get a permanent president in place. And that's extremely important. We must have a successful presidential search. That will start immediately this summer with listening sessions, and then hiring a search firm and starting that search in earnest in the early fall with a permanent president in place by June 2019. That's what I can control now and continue working every day to try to make Michigan State University a better place, more inclusive, safer, changing the culture at the university. And that's a lot of hard work that needs focus every single day of the week.
You supported the choice of John Engler for interim president. Why at the time did you feel he was the right person?
I think what we need to focus on today is where we're at now and how we can move forward in the future. And I've made my comments known. I've been very forceful that I think that John Engler is not the leader for Michigan State University. And in order to move up forward, that he should resign and that we should aggressively start the presidential search.
Do you regret the choice?
Again, what we should focus on is today and into the future. You can learn from the past, but we need to focus on the future. And the future is, I've asked for a public apology. That has not happened. I don't believe that John Engler is the right leader for Michigan State University, and that we need to be focused on the future and getting started on that presidential search.
Diane Byram is a member of the Michigan State Board of Trustees. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." Yet in January, Congress and the president extended warrantless surveillance of phone calls, emails, your Facebook page and messages, just about anything you use to communicate with people. For 6 more years, the NSA, the National Security Agency, is allowed to spy on U.S. citizens. We found out the government was surveilling us because Edward Snowden showed reporters classified NSA documents. Several states since then have introduced bills banning cooperation with the NSA and its warrantless searches. Few have actually passed, but a bill in Michigan did pass. Republican Representative Martin Hauerlach's proposal goes into effect Sunday, June 17th. Representative Hauerlach joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So what does this law actually do?
So the law is pretty straightforward, and for all intents and purposes, it says that the state of Michigan will not participate in any unconstitutional endeavors with the United States government. And that really is, in a nutshell, what it is. And so it's very specific about what the Fourth Amendment means, and there are a couple of provisions in this bill that make it very clear so folks don't have to brush off their Constitution and know what they can and cannot do.
So what did you think this was necessary?
Well, on a practical level, we certainly don't want Michigan to do anything along the lines of what Utah did. Utah has a very large data gathering operation operated by the NSA in Provo, Utah. And obviously, utilities and access to that building are provided by state and local governments. And so, if nothing else, it just says, look, if the feds want to do that, if they want to spy on you as citizens, they're not going to do it from Michigan's soil. And Michigan is not going to participate in it. But I think on a bigger picture, it just sends a very strong message to Washington, and hopefully other states will join us in sending that strong message to Washington and also to our legislators at the Capitol in Washington, that they need to rein in the amount of domestic spying that they have and also slow down the expansion of the capabilities of the U.S. government to spy on its own citizens. There's a strong message that we're sending, and I think we're a trailblazer, too. And you don't hear that or you hadn't heard that much about Michigan in the past. But along with our economy being a trailblazer now, we're also being a trailblazer for constitutional rights.
Yeah, I think California was the only other state that has a law that bans cooperating with the federal government in a warrantless search. Why do you think other states have not done so if there's widespread belief this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution?
I think that a lot is happening when it comes to domestic eavesdropping, spying, data gathering that is not very well known to the public at large. And obviously, legislators in Michigan as well as other states want to make sure that the federal government has the capabilities that it needs to in order to protect us from obviously foreign agents who want to do harm against the U.S. and its citizens. So this bill, in particular the Michigan bill, was crafted to really thread that needle, to both be very strong about not violating the constitutional rights of U.S. citizens, while also ensuring that state and its local subdivisions can properly go about their job. We didn't want to inadvertently ban something that we've been doing in Michigan for years and years that's completely legal, so we need to be very careful about that. And we also are very strong in taking a stand on the Fourth Amendment. I have no idea why we have what should be very conservative, non-activist courts being very activist when it comes to allowing the federal government to do things on its own citizens that it really shouldn't be allowed to do.
Now, this was approved in an overwhelmingly bipartisan support in the legislature. Were you surprised by that?
Yes, pleasantly surprised. We only had one no vote in either chamber. And so both parties, the Democrats, were very strongly in favor of it, as were the Republicans. And I think the person who voted no, if I had some more time to talk to him, and he's a good friend of mine, then he may have felt differently as well. So we were very pleasantly surprised. And this is at least the third time this bill or some version of it's been introduced in the House.
I'm wondering why you think there's such a difference of opinion about warrantless searches of our electronic papers, the messages, the phone calls, difference of opinion between Michigan lawmakers and Washington lawmakers.
Well, part of it is, and you're seeing this really across all policy matters at state and federal government, is, you know, technology is changing. And so a lot of your statutes at the state level in particular are dealing with old technology, whether it's at tax issues or whether it be constitutional protection issues that are embedded in state laws. And so I think that's part of it. I think there's also part of the issue about just there not being a strong knowledge about what's happening. And I'd like to give our Congress in Washington the benefit of the doubt. Maybe I shouldn't, I don't know, but maybe these folks just don't know what they're doing on a practical level. Maybe they're just so far removed from the trenches, if you will. They don't know what's really happening out there. That doesn't sound very good for them, but that's the best I can, because I really don't know. I mean, I think that they can easily provide the government, the federal government, the tools they need in order to do its constitutional role of protecting our country from foreign agents who want to do harm to us. But there are other law enforcement mechanisms for anybody who is a U.S. citizen who is up to some mischief, and we need to abide by the rights embedded in the Constitution to protect those who we believe are doing harm and to give them the benefit of the doubt. In other words, innocent until proven guilty, and guilty only when proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Republican Representative Martin Hauerlich sponsored a bill to ban Michigan law enforcement and public utilities from cooperating with the federal government and warrantless surveillance of electronic communications of U.S. citizens. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much, Lester.
The Michigan legislature approved a budget before leaving for the summer recess. It would be impossible to go over everything in the budget, but we've asked our Friday commentators to come up with the highlights and the lowlights of the budget. Joining me are Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us via Skype. Vicki, let's start with you. What do you think is right in this budget?
I think increasing per pupil funding for education is right in this budget. I'm very pleased to see that there are some increases, $120 per pupil for the most wealthier funded districts, and then $240 per pupil to start closing that gap a little more between the lower funded districts. And I think it's a good thing. We're moving in the right direction in terms of per pupil funding.
Ken, what'd you find in the budget that you liked?
There's a lot of good things in the budget, in part because there was additional revenue, $500 million of additional revenue identified a month ago. So there's more money for schools, more money for roads, more money for career training, and more money for the rainy day fund. All of that is good.
Vicki, what did you find in the budget that you didn't like?
I didn't like that there were policy inserts into the budget, especially in the school funding bill, about underperforming schools, that policy issues should not belong in a funded budget. Some other things that I thought were concerning was the maintenance of a general fund at about $10 billion. While that sounds great to the people of the state of Michigan, it really means we're moving backward in terms of the amount of money we have to spend with general fund, general purpose revenue.
Okay, you're gonna explain that. General fund's the big checkbook, the normal checkbook that's not earmarked for things. So why does that make a difference?
Because that is the discretionary funding in the budget that funds most of the things we talk about. When we talk about a $56.8 billion budget, only about $10.5 billion of that, and that's a lot of money. I'm not saying it's not a lot of money, but that has remained static for the last 20 years. And that's my concern, that we're not living up to our promise of holding to inflationary increases only. We are going backward. Now, we are being very fiscally responsible in our budget, but we're letting a lot of things slide, like roads, like underground infrastructure, like water testing, and making sure that the Great Lakes are protected and putting more money into all of that infrastructure. We've also taken money out of local communities, leaving them very dire straits, and that is not good for the state of Michigan.
Ken, anything in this budget make you raise an eyebrow?
You know, there's always dust-ups and controversies in a budget like this, but kind of in keeping with the theme that you and Vicki were on, you know, there's going to be a day of reckoning. Wasn't this year because of the economy, but when you depend on the general fund for things like roads, which historically have been funded with user fees like gas taxes, when you depend on the school aid fund to fund universities and community colleges, as this budget does, when the economy goes south, there's going to be a day of reckoning. But it wasn't this year. It'll be down the road.
You know, it wasn't that long ago when the legislature was habitually haggling over budget details much farther into the fiscal year. What's changed?
I think that legislators got smart and realized that this last-minute haggling and threatening to shut down the government is not useful. It's not a good policy. And the longer we stretch this out into the summer, the longer and the more dangerous it gets in terms of brinkmanship. So the idea of trying to have a budget in place, even though it's really not mandatory that it be settled in summer, this is a very good thing. This now gives the school districts the opportunity to plan because their budgets have to be in place by July 1. And it gives local communities time to understand what's going on with their funding because they also have to have, many of them, their budgets in place by July 1. I think this was a smart move on the part of the governor to insist that we move this forward so that the haggling is done earlier. Most of the budget numbers are based on the May consensus revenue estimate. The governor gives his input in February, and there's no reason why it should be delayed. So I am pleased to see that. I am disappointed, however, in, again, another policy statement in here, to defund Planned Parenthood, which provides health care to 420,000 women across the state of Michigan, women and men.
And the governor has indicated that probably is not going to fly. Ken, has it been Governor Snyder that's led to the legislature getting this budget in early?
Oh, he deserves some credit for that because he insisted on it. But the real test for getting the budget done before the October 1st start of the state's fiscal year will be if you have a governor of one party and a legislature of another on top of having a recession. That's going to be the test of how easy and quickly you can get a budget done. It's a lot easier to do it if you have one party control the government and the economy's good and revenue's pouring in, which is the case right now.
That's Ken Sikkema, a former Republican member of the legislature, and Vicki Barnett, a former Democratic member of the legislature. Hey, good to talk to you guys. It's been a while.
Yes, it has.
Thanks, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock. He's back at the controls and as surly as ever. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sophie Sherry, and Joy Horan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.